Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Russell Sorg about chromosome disorder outreach. So tell me a little bit about chromosome deletion outreach.
CDO was founded in 1992 as a nonprofit, built to support families that have children that were born with rare genetic disorders. And these are disorders that are not part of major groups or well-known in the medical community. And it puts families in a precarious situation because they're unable to get a roadmap or support to help their children. So CDO came together to gather similar diagnosis and medical symptoms and help people to connect with each other.
So how do you go about spreading the word and reaching out to these families who may be affected?
Well, a lot of it is word of mouth, of course, but the biggest help is the website and just people doing searches on the web, finding resources. There's also a Facebook and Twitter connection as well from a social media perspective.
So, are there any challenges in bringing the appropriate information to these families about what a rare condition might be or how they can seek help?
Well, challenges in that sense would stem from probably depending on how rare the situation is, there may not be other children with the same or similar diagnoses. That creates a challenge for families to get information.
So in presenting rare disorders, do you see a lot of myths and stereotypes concerning any given conditions out there?
Not really in our realm. I think it's because the incidence and the type of condition that CDO members and families are experiencing just don't have that necessary stigma or that familiarity that maybe others have with that are in part of larger groups.
So what are some of the biggest challenges for CDO?
Well, like any nonprofit, you know, it's always the funding and probably the primary. One of the things is volunteers as well, getting the volunteers and the funding because everybody's busy and money's always in short supply. The group does very well. There are some needs that the group has. A genetic counselor being one of the primary ones. There is a geneticist on staff who's able to provide a lot of support and a lot of answers to families. But a genetic counselor is a position that I think CDO would benefit tremendously from.
So, to look at the converse side of things, in your time with CDO, has there been any success moment stands out for you?
Well, I'll tell you, the group has been around for 27 years now, and it continues to grow, and that in itself is extremely encouraging. For the last 4 or 5 years, CDO has been named one of the great nonprofits. But the most important thing is when you get a letter or a phone call from a family that has found tremendous benefit from using the group and connecting with other families or connecting with the geneticist to learn more about their child. That in itself is the most rewarding part of this organization.
So, are there any projects on the horizon for CDO?
I think right now, I think it's, rare chromosome disorder week, awareness week is starting this Sunday. Goes for a week. So there's a lot of Twitter activity, activity on the web and Facebook and on the website around the world, paying attention to this rare chromosome disorder week. I think another aspect that the group is working towards is stepping up and improving their social media connectivity and communication. Looking for perhaps a volunteer on the group, within the group, or outside the group that would be willing to support that, to help spread that word like you asked about earlier.
So, if you could send any message to the community about why CDO's work is important, what would you say?
I think probably the biggest piece of it is for the community to realize, even though it's rare, you're not alone. There's other families. And because of the internet and social media and the groups like CDO, we've been able to put together the resources to really help people, even if the diagnosis is not exact. Even if, if you can come in the same area of some of these genetic disorders, that support means an awful lot to those families. Because there's nothing like getting news when you have a brand new baby or a baby or a child that's young, that there's a problem, and it's a genetic problem, and there's not a lot of answers. That's a very, very scary thing. And that would be my message, or our message to the world, is that this is a group that's here to help navigate.
So how can audience members go about getting more information about the work you do?
You can visit the website, chromodisorder.org. They can, just kind of look through some of the stories about the families, some of the resources and the successes that are out there. There's probably other pieces of information about related groups or other specialty groups that specialize in certain disorders, things like that. So that would be the best way to really understand this environment.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you, Cam.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Kim Angel from the MPS Society. So what can you tell me about the society?
Hi. Well, the Canadian MPS Society was founded in 1984 by a woman named Sheila Lee. And Sheila's first child passed away quite young, undiagnosed. And when her second child started showing symptoms, the same symptoms and presentations as her first child, she started doing more investigation on her own, and finally the second child was diagnosed with MPS. So from there, Sheila was trying to find information about the disease and families that she could connect with, and was having a really difficult time with it. So she chose to found the Canadian MPS Society, and from there, we've been working towards supporting families, bringing families together, connecting them so they have an incredible network of peer support. We provide financial assistance to families when things like home renovations or certain medical equipment not covered, we'll help them out financially through our financial assistance program. And we provide education and resources to families. So we have a number of published binders and books that help families understand the disease and understand aspects that go along with MPS, such as daily living, financial impact, and resources, medical management, social, emotional support, and things like that. We have a 1-800 number, which we're accessible at all times, and are there to just support families as much as we possibly can, in any way we can. And then we're very excited. We're hosting our 2019 National Family Conference at the end of July at the Nottawasaga Inn and Resort in Alliston, Ontario. And we're bringing families together with different researchers and physicians and presenters to connect them and create and strengthen their network and also provide further education through our presentation. But then we also have an amazing children's program where children with MPS and their siblings can attend this really fantastically structured kids program throughout the weekend so the parents can focus on the information being provided to them at the conference.
So what are some of the more common impacts that MPS can have? I understand there are different types, but what do you typically see in your work?
Well, there again, because there are so many different types, each case typically presents differently. So there's MPS 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and 7. But when you look at MPS 1, there's MPS 1 Hurler and Hurler Shea. There is MPS 2, there's MPS 3, A, B, C, and D. MPS 4 has MPS 4, A, and B. So it goes on. So each type and subtype presents differently. There are types of the disease that affect the brain and the neurocognitive development. These types are typically the most impactful to the individual and have the most severe phenotype, so how it's presenting in the body. So there are enzyme replacement therapy for some of the types of disease, which slows down the progression. And basically, with MPS, what the disease, there's a defective enzyme, and again, each genotype is different with each type, but this enzyme is responsible for breaking down protein in the body or saccharide in the body. And because this enzyme is defective, these saccharides, they're called glycosaminoglycans, build up and accumulate. And it's multisystemic, so joints, bones, organs, and then in some cases, brain and spinal cord. So many of the individuals with MPS have very visible presentations of the disease, short stature, their bones and joints are very, very either limber or carpal tunnel syndrome. There's coarse facial features, protruding teeth, a flattened nose, all sorts of presentations of this.
So
it's really varied, it's a very impactful on the entire system.
So in your time with the society, has there been any success story that you'd like to share?
Certainly. One in particular is our board chair. Her name is Melissa Bilodeau. She was diagnosed with Morquio A. When she was quite young. She's now 24 years old, has just in the process of completing her master's at Montreal University, an absolutely brilliant young lady. Sits on the board of the RQMO in Quebec, which is another support group for Morphio patients. She's just a vibrant, beautiful, intelligent young woman who, although the disease has, you know, taken an effect on her body, she's in a wheelchair, has had multiple surgeries, you know, lots of constant pain in certain areas, and she's confined to her enzyme replacement therapy on a regular basis, but that hasn't stopped her from really actively and fully living her life. And she's an incredible advocate for living your best life with a rare disease. That I would say would be one of our significant success stories with MCS.
So when you say a rare disease, do you happen to know how many people are affected?
MPS diseases affect approximately 1 in 25,000 live births, and this is globally. So in Canada, we're aware, through the Canadian MPS Society, we're aware of about 200, just over 200 affected individuals that have been diagnosed and have been referred to our organization and are members of the Canadian MPS Society, but we know that there are more. So one of our strategic action plans for 2019 to 2021 is to identify and map patients in Canada, and beyond that, potentially create a Canadian MPS registry.
Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Are you heading out to a cottage this summer? Well, here are some helpful tips to stay bear-wise while enjoying your cottage vacation. Put garbage in containers with tight-fitting lids and only put it out on garbage day, not the night before. Remove grease and food residue from barbecue grills, including the grease trap, after each use. When packing up, remember to remove all food from inside your cottage. A box of pudding or fruit-flavored dessert mix is all it takes to attract a bear. Remember that you are responsible for your own personal safety. Take necessary precautions when you are outdoors, and don't invite any bears to the cottage this summer. Visit ontario.ca/bearwise for more information on bears.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Russell Sorg about chromosome disorders and from Kim Angel about the MPS Society. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Danielle Stranad from DramaWay. So tell me a little bit about DramaWay.
So I began DramaWay back in 1999. So we're celebrating now our 20th year in the business, which is really exciting. And essentially when I started the company, it was just me and only about six participants, and we were just running, you know, essentially at that time it was just drama classes. And then basically through the years it expanded to now essentially we're offering multi-arts programs that span the realm of the fine arts, and we're servicing over about 350 individuals on a weekly basis.
And can you tell me a little bit about the disabilities aspect of it?
Yeah, so when we first began, we were working with all abilities, but including like mainstream, typical functioning individuals. Through the years, we found that specializing and working with all abilities, people with varying different disabilities was, you know, the better choice, because it just seemed that there wasn't a lot of services that particularly within the arts that offered quality arts programming. There was a lot of programs within Toronto, but I was getting a lot of feedback from families saying that there was nothing that was offering the quality and the level that Dramaway was getting to know, you know, getting known as. So essentially, we just started offering that at, with the demands of the caregivers and the families, and it just led to us developing a wide range of programs. So essentially, I would say probably 75% of the participants who started to come mainly have a developmental delay or have Down syndrome. But we also have a whole wide range. You know, you might have someone with Fragile X or CP, or, you know, we also have a wide range of clients that come from the mental health arena. So they might be dealing with, you know, some mental health issues, whether it be schizophrenia or, you know, depression. Sometimes it's a dual diagnosis issue where people are coming with various different issues that they're dealing with. We've also sometimes connected with Epilepsy Toronto, so some people are dealing with seizures and other different issues. And, you know, we've just found a way with the supports and the different staff and volunteers that we work with to aim to have like a 5-to-1 ratio within the program. So it's very well supported for everyone that's coming. Sometimes, obviously, if someone has extreme behaviors or extreme medical needs, then they are coming with a one-on-one. What happens is some of the families are, like, some individuals might have higher medical needs, so complex medical needs, whether they're on a respirator or, you know, they might have some toileting and hygiene needs. So some of them may come with a one-on-one support worker, and they incorporate within the program, and we work alongside those support workers when there's extreme behaviors or probably extreme medical needs. But other than that, it's pretty much a 5-to-1 ratio.
So can you tell me a little bit about how a person with a disability might respond to the work that goes on, what sort of impact it has on them once they get involved with the arts?
I think probably best each of them could speak to themselves, but I can share what I've heard from them and from their families. And what I typically hear is just that, you know, at a lot of places, they don't really get the attention that they do at Dramaway. So at Dramaway, we really try and personalize and individualize the programming to suit each individual. So to give you a concrete example, one of our most popular programs is the drama program and the dance program. And so, for example, this past year when we were doing the dance program, each individual was, you know, interviewed, and we communicated with them personally within the class, having private and group chats about what their goals were. We also then talked about, you know, the theme that we were having, which this year it just happened to be about the human body and connecting around that. And so each person shared, you know, their personal connections in regard to that. And so the dance was created based on each of their needs. Some of them were struggling with different issues, you know, and some of it gets a little bit in depth, so I probably won't go into that. But the reality is, you know, some of their solos were designed personally on what their personal goals were or their feelings around. For example, if it was a female, it would be something about her menstrual time or, you know, the connection. We had some comedy brought in there around, you know, connecting around relationships. And so there's different variations. When it comes to drama, you know, each of our scripts, we might have anywhere from 12 to 17 actors in each play. And so for each actor, when we're getting the script, despite having probably 6 scripts that could be 40 pages long, each of those are personally adapted by myself and the staff for each individual, knowing what their level, their verbal level is, what their comprehension is, what their receptive language is. Some of them may need additional props, whether they have, you know, limited mobility or something like that. And all of that is taken into place and written in and adapted so that it can really suit what their needs are.
So have you ever worked with someone who was nonverbal in their communication?
Yes. So we have a fair bit of nonverbal individuals within the program. And sometimes what will be happening is we might incorporate signage. We might do some pre-recorded voiceovers where maybe they might choose another actor who might say their line for them. Sometimes there's even individuals who are verbal, but their language is almost unaudible by most people. So they might speak almost in a gibberish manner that's very difficult unless you understand that client, have dealt with that client a lot. So if it's just a one-time show, the audience members might not understand what that individual's saying. But at DramaWay, one of the things that I feel is a staple thing that I developed many years ago out of almost desperation is the level of narration. And so this is something that you do in young people's theater when you're working with children. Usually you're narrating it, and then the children are coming in and out, or story theater does this as a genre, very popular. And what we've done is I've adapted that so that the narration can be throughout the play, and the prompts are then inherent within the narration. If it's someone that's high functioning and very verbal, I obviously can pull away from some of those prompts because the individual can do it. If it's someone that we're not really understanding audibly and they need some clarification, I might say it before. I might say, well, Rocky said, how come? I want to know. And then the person might say his or her lines. And if it's not audible, the audience has already heard what the line is. And so that's kind of how we've been able to work it in. Obviously, when it's in a classroom setting and we're not necessarily performing on stage or performing for a group, there's a whole bunch of different tools that we might be using, whether it's creating, you know, a training tool on YouTube where they visually watch it, and then they have some gestures and actions that they're working on so that this is a sequence that, you know, he or she can develop through the weeks when they're not in class. We obviously incorporate visual aids that we've created plenty of, you know, visuals so that, you know, the individual can use them, or at least we can interact with him or her using the visuals and he can point to it. Often it just may be as simple as incorporating a prop that they hold up, and then we know based on writing it that, you know, he or she has to hold that balloon up, or, you know, hold up the locket if it's the play of Annie or something like that. So there's various different ways that we do it, just depending on what discipline we're working on, whether it's dance, drama, visual arts, and then we just, you know, go from there. A lot of time it's trial and error. You're trying something. You might create something that we've adapted and think that it worked for that individual. Maybe we gave, you know, him or her too many lines or too little lines, and she can do something different. Sometimes we see something come out from the client that we've never seen just in rehearsals, and we think, oh, that's beautiful, you know. She may not be able to speak it audibly, but when she sings, her tonality is a lot more clearer. So then we work in a song, you know, or a solo for that individual. We try and be adaptable.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
It's interesting that DramaWay works with those who might have a mental health condition. Fact is, I've always said, disabilities athletics are what frees a person in terms of their body. They're just living in the moment. I wonder if it's so for someone with a mental health condition, being on stage, being appreciated for who and what they are. I can't help but wonder, could a person who struggled with something like depression look at the world in a new way just for being seen as contributing to society? Contributing to the culture and the betterment of our great landscape. The fact is, regardless of how a person moves or speaks or thinks or views the world in general, we all have something to contribute. It's when you start looking beyond the surface, beyond the obvious, that we come to a place where a person can truly be appreciated, no matter what our perceptions of what they can and cannot do may be. A smart mind, an open mind, is one that allows for growth and the possibility of learning something new. Learning different perspectives can, in fact, change the world. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.